This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
War is the lowest form of communication. Blam, blam, blam.
I was considered a premature anti-fascist. That was before the army got orders to be against fascism.
It was a time when you weren't allowed to break down. You weren't allowed to get sick.
And I said, boy, we're going to get it now. Sure, here it comes.
And even if you were sick, you still showed up because literally people will die if you don't show up.
I looked up and all his whole body was gone. Top of his body was gone.
I guess I learned how to survive.
Oh, I don't go insane easily. I don't panic and I don't enthuse very much.
No, rock and roll music kept me sane here. I was there. Really, really, really.
Hello again. Welcome to Hitchhiking Off the Map, a show about journeys. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. 2 years ago, we did a show called War Veterans, when we were thinking what kinds of journeys really cause you to see the world with different eyes.
And since war has not, during the course of this time, faded from the memory of the human race, well, maybe from the memory, our memory is about 5 minutes long these days, but not from the agenda or the budget. And in recognition of Veterans Day, we'd like to rebroadcast that show.
We talked to 14 people from wars far enough back, nothing later than Vietnam, to allow a perspective on it as one of the experiences in the whole span of life.
What was it for these people as a part of their lives? This is War Veterans.
This is a war universe. War all the time. That is its nature. There may be other universes based on all sorts of other principles, but ours seems to be based on war and games.
War is thus divine in itself, since it is a law of the world. War is divine in the mysterious glory that surrounds it, and in the no less inexplicable attraction that draws us to it. War alone brings up to their highest tension all human energies and imposes the stamp of nobility upon the peoples who have the courage to make it.
I would say it boosted my draft, they say. So you could volunteer for the draft, unfortunately. And so I did 2 years, signed up for 2 years, and told them I wanted to be either a chaplain's assistant or a medic. And fortunately enough, they made me a medic.
No, I was I enlisted primarily because my father asked me one day when I'd been out of high school a few weeks. I wasn't really doing much but just kind of partying, and he said, well, you've got to go to school, get a job, or go in the military. So anyway, he pulled out his Airborne album and showed me his, he was in the paratroopers and in the Army 22 years, and he showed me that album and kind of lured me into that, which turned out to be kind of a mistake in a way, because if you're going to enlist in the military, you should consider that you might be able to get something out of it, possibly. And I joined up as a paratrooper, and then they put you actually into like an infantry outfit, which put you in harm's way, you know, and that isn't really what my intention was. I just wanted to be a paratrooper, but I didn't know what that was. So, you know, my father didn't really give me a complete picture.
Well, I came from a small town in Pennsylvania, and I went back to New York City when I was 17 and went to nursing school at a place called NYU Bellevue. After my graduation, I worked in their emergency room, which is probably the biggest trauma center in the United States, and got an awful lot of experience. And when I finally, after 2 or 3 years, felt like I had conquered that, one of my crazy friends said, why don't we go to Vietnam? It'll be like Paris in the war. And it seemed like a great challenge. So off I went. And it wasn't quite like Paris.
So I got in. And a few months after I got in, they started the lottery. And I remember when the lottery numbers came out in the newspaper, and I looked up my birthday, June 24th, and I said, wow, number 358, there's no way they're going to draft me. But I was wearing a green uniform, and I was standing in the barracks as I said that, so it was a few months too late to save me from joining.
At the time, I had graduated from college, and I had a degree in English. And I graduated in Boston, and I'd moved back home to Texas because I didn't have a job, and my family was in Texas. And I was very undirected. I hadn't a clue what to do with myself. And I had gone to Catholic schools my entire education, and I was totally not interested in the military or anything to do with uniforms. But one day I was looking for work in Houston, and I ran into a guy that I knew that I had liked. And he and I went out for coffee, and he was really upset because he was engaged and he really needed the job and all this. But nobody would hire him because he was 1A and he was in the Marine Corps Reserve. And I came away from that just feeling like it was not fair. It was really not fair that because he was a guy, he had to deal with that. And because I was a girl, I didn't. And somehow, I mean, looking back, it's kind of hard to trace all that, but somehow that really affected me. Like, this isn't fair. And so the next day, I think, I actually went down and talked to the recruiter.
Well, the Germans were saying, today, Germany, heute, Deutschland, and morgen, die ganze Welt, tomorrow, the whole world. And they couldn't do that without a war. So the place to stop them was Spain. And if it weren't for the governments of Britain and France and the United States, we would have stopped them in Spain. I was unemployed, so I was free.
I mean, for me, it was a lark.
Well, I really went on whim. And I was looking for adventure.
No, it had to do with the war itself, really.
For me, it was like a way to get out of Baytown, Texas.
I hated New York City. went into nursing school, and when an Army recruiter came around and asked if I wanted to join, I thought, yeah, well, why not? And I said, well, do I have to go to Vietnam? You know, the Vietnam War was happening at the time. And she said, oh, no, you don't have to go to Vietnam. Women have to volunteer.
It may have been something like waking up one morning and hearing that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. I was in high school at the time. My friends and I all got together immediately and decided what we were going to do, and we were all going to enlist in one service or another. Several of us went into the Air Force. Within a week, we'd signed up, and then it was a matter of waiting.
I was an art student living in Denver, Colorado, going to class at night, working, a grunt job to get enough money to pay rent and tuition and things like that. And a family friend said, oh, you've been struggling so hard to get through school, and then you can be an officer, and they'll cover all your education. And I was at a place where anything looked better than where I was. And I came from a family. My dad was a Marine in two wars. Not a lifetime military person, but, so I was raised with a citizenship streak, I call it that rather than patriotism, but citizenship, feeling like that everyone should do something important for our country, whether it's Peace Corps or, I guess for me, it turned out to be the military.
Flying was everywhere. All my friends and I were running around the yard making flying noises with our mouths and flying little toy airplanes and crashing them and colliding them and playing war.
And I went, oh, well, this is cool. I can leave New York City. I can do something in response to John F. Kennedy's What Can You Do for Your Country? Because he was somebody that was very important to me. I was in junior high school, about 12, 13, when he was assassinated, and I was greatly affected by that.
I was flunking out of college. It took me 2.5 years to lose my student deferment and get drafted. And instead of going into the Army, I was prevailed upon by my father, who was an Air Force pilot, to enlist in the Air Force, and that's what I did. I idolized him, and I was not at all sure that he wasn't right to be supporting the war. I didn't really want to go look, but it was more interesting than what I was doing at the UCLA at the time.
And looking back, I feel like I was so naive.
We had to fight we were part of that war. We caused it to happen because we stayed out of the League of Nations.
I was just out of high school, and I had a chance to play pro baseball. And I had a chance to play with Oakland Oaks. And Billy Martin was there, and Casey Stengel was a manager. And they saw me play here, and they asked me to come down, and they wanted to sign me. And I was already drafted, so I couldn't go. I was just on 21-day leave, and I was playing this ball game, you know, and they saw me and they wanted to take me. And that was one of the biggest breaks I had in my life that I couldn't complete, you know, because of the war. And during the war, my life had changed.
War is the great scavenger of thought. It is the sovereign disinfectant, and its red stream of blood cleans out the stagnant pools and clotted channels of the intellect.
When these people tell their stories, the story has a coherence, or at least there's an urge toward coherence. Even if it's a string of anecdotes, there's some kind of grasp at meaning. So listening to these stories in fragments, as we're doing, kind of betrays the stories in a way. And yet, in another sense, that's how they were lived. And if you hear the stories, you remember them in fragments. So think of this as more walking along the beach, picking up pieces of shell.
Well, it was very exciting for about the first 3 days. And then I arrived in basic training.
Well, that was funny. After spending a year being trained to be a highly trained signal technician, I dug ditches for the first month. I learned to fix trucks for about a month. And then largely after that, I drove trucks and ran a log cabin bar for the troops.
And I got out of the school. The taxpayers had just spent many thousands of dollars and 6.5 months of my time teaching me to make maps. And they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas for my duty station, and they said, "A map maker, huh? Gee, we don't need any map makers here. Would you rather be infantry, artillery, or armor?" So I said to myself, infantry's right in the middle of the crapola, and armor's in the middle of it, but they've got a shell around them. But artillery's a couple miles back. So I said, "I'll be artillery, thank you."
So it's that thing of, you know, getting up in the morning and putting on your web gear and getting your ammo and your hand grenades and your rifle and make sure you got a machine gunner sitting next to you. And we had rules, and we couldn't go without a spotter plane, an O-1 bird dog. And it had to have a minimum of 3 vehicles, and you had to have a minimum of 6 guys and 2 radios and 2 machine guns and stuff like that. So I guess we were taking it seriously. So I would make that drive, and every time I drove by where they'd killed all these guys, I would, you know, wonder, was this the time that they get me?
Well, I guess the most dangerous situation would be just being shot at.
Well, we got shot at with artillery quite frequently. But other than that, we weren't terribly close.
Well, I have an interesting situation because I don't know if I killed anybody, but I tried. And then I saw people killed, and I did shoot at people that I could see. But it's all very crazy and insane, and it all happens very fast. And you don't really always know what happened. And so that's just something to live with. That's something that, you know, people don't believe in ghosts, but ask a veteran, a combat veteran, and they know what ghosts are. Even if they're flying at 30,000 feet dropping bombs, they have to live with that for, you know, the rest of their life.
The biggest danger was once when a ship blew up under us. We were supposed to have 2-second delay fuses, but on this occasion, the bomb went right in the side of the ship and hit the magazine. And there was instant detonation, and we could see wreckage flying up around us. We were flying through a cloud of wreckage. I looked out my window, and I could swear to this day that I saw a startled Japanese sailor blown up out of the ship at eye level, looking at me as the plane whizzed by.
And airplanes were swooping and rising over there, and it looked so beautiful until we realized they were strafing. That was the second line. We were the third line. And then all of a sudden, a line of tanks came over the top and came down. It got about halfway down, and the hills started turning black. It was the Italian army.
and I ended up on an intensive care unit that was half burns, severe burns, and half amputations. When it was a simple amputation, it was not a problem, but if it was an amputation with belly wounds and chest wounds, we're talking complications, and that's who we ended up with in the ICU unit. And the burns were severe burns, usually phosphorus burns from phosphorus grenades, which burned all the way through the flesh. You could smell the flesh.
So that shifted to taking guys from helicopters into the ER and, you know, changing an IV, cutting their clothes off, cut the boots off, cut their clothes off to see. Tell it more experienced the nurses and doctors deal with the wounds that they have, you know, cutting bandages off them.
Anyway, we used to tease and flirt and try to keep their minds off their wounds when we were triaging and going through and starting the IVs and getting them ready for the operating room. So coming down the line, I had maybe 15 or 20 patients to assess. About a third or fourth down the line, I see this kidney's laying on his stomach, and he's absolutely gorgeous. I'm talking Brad Pitt gorgeous. He has like golden eyebrows that are kind of like sun bleached, and this big shock of yellow hair, and his eyes, I'll never forget, were like bottled green, and they were so beautiful. And I just said to him, you know, you've got the most beautiful green eyes I ever saw. And he arched his neck back, and the whole rest of his face was shot away. Well, you don't forget things like that. They stay with you. They stay with you when you see green eyes. And that's the kind of thing that stays stamped on your brain. You look at that kid and you think, he's never going to laugh. He's never going to kiss. He's never going to talk or sing. And then, of course, you go into automatic mode, and you turn him over, and you get the tracheostomy set up, you call the doctors over, and you secure his airway, and you get him ready for the operating room, and off he goes, and you never see him again.
War makes rattling good history, but peace is poor reading. War is nothing but the continuation of state policy with other means. This war, like the next war, is a war to end war.
Mostly, I tried to be invisible, do my time, get out.
And we hauled these tanks up, and the tank crews, like I say, the tank crews got in the tanks and drove them off. We sat down and we were going to have dinner. The company that we took them to, they fixed us dinner. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. Trucks were driving fast, going crazy all over the place. And what it was the rumors had started that the Germans had broken through. So we started out to take off, and when we got out on the road and saw all the people screaming around, it was just unbelievable, the panic that existed. Turns out that the problem was some GI had gotten drunk and was shooting at Frenchmen, and that was a German breakthrough.
And the Spanish roads are Roman roads. Straight like a ruler from town to town. So they would mount machine guns and fire down the highways at night. We were put in column of two down the ditches. And the bullets went down the road. So we were perfectly safe. But it's the sound of a spent bullet it's as if it's just drifting along hunting.
You know, my job in England was to be the what they call the WAF squadron commander. My mandate when I first got there, the only thing the colonel told me he really cared about was I was to make sure that none of these girls got pregnant and had a baby on active duty. I have no idea how they expected me to do that. Now, girls, don't you get pregnant. Yes, ma'am, we won't. You know. Oh, God, that was a funny place. It was a funny place.
And it's got its good side. You meet guys from all over. It broadens you a bit, you know. You make some friends.
And, you know, we go to the chow hall for lunch and ask, well, can I have a leg? And the guy would give you this funny look and say, well, it's fish. It's like, okay, just give me something. Food was not a high point.
Well, about that time, they told us to get out of there. And on the way out was when I got wounded. Felt like a sledgehammer, and it broke my leg.
And they were all getting ready to go, as I said, to Thailand. And I was the training officer, the ground training officer. So a bunch of the guys came to me one time, and they said, you know, Lieutenant, they got some really terrible snakes in the jungles over there. And we're going to have special training, snake survival training. So they were very serious. They had me all worked up about this snake survival training. And they told me about snakes like the bedwetting cobra. But, oh, my God, you poor guys. They literally had me calling around to universities to find a herpetologist who would come in and conduct snake survival school. They let that go on for about 3 days. And then they finally admitted that it was all a bunch of bull. So, man, I was mad.
And we flew very tight formation, and that of course, masked all our guns, and an incoming fighter would meet the firepower of a couple hundred guns. Tracer bullets would converge on the plane, and it was terrifying for fighter pilots to see that, and many of them chickened out. Many of them just couldn't get themselves to fly through the cone of fire. On the other hand, once we got into it, once in a while we'd get a kamikaze trying to hit us, usually trying to hit the lead plane. I don't know, at least one occasion a kamikaze flew directly at me, and I had to dump the plane. I just shoved the wheel forward and got out of the way, and the plane whizzed over. Barely missed.
We didn't take care of prisoners at all for a long time. They were just put in a kind of a corral and play coup. And if they died of their wounds, they died of their wounds. And so one day, my commander comes into the Quonset hut, and he said, we've changed our policy, and we're going to begin treating wounded prisoners. And I rejoiced. I thought this was absolutely wonderful. Well, he had a guy with him who brought out like a ream of paperwork and said, what we're doing is a study on the effectiveness of our weaponry. But anyway, we took the prisoners and we did the paperwork. And pretty soon we had a Quonset hut that was absolutely full of prisoners. And it stunk in there. You know, we were raised in the 40s where the Americans were the good guys. So it gives you pause.
War can only be abolished through war. In order to get rid of the gun, it is necessary to take up the gun.
Of course, when I was in the hedgerows, at one time I was a scout. So every morning I'd leave the company or leave the squad and go out 100 yards ahead and proceed to contact the enemy. I like that, being a scout, because I make my own decisions. One time I was in scout and I was going across this field and I saw a sun glitter on the barrel of a gun. So I turned around and started to run back to where I came over the hedgerow, and the machine gun started firing at me, and I could see the bullets going between my legs when I was running. And of course, that made me run all the faster. So when I got to the hedgerow, I grabbed a limb to dive over it, and he cut the limb right out of my hand. And I dove over the hedgerow, and when I sat there with my second scout that was behind me about 50 to 75 yards, I started laughing. We both were laughing that he missed us. I couldn't believe it, you know.
War ought to be the only study of a prince. He ought to consider peace only as a breathing time, which gives him leisure to contrive military plans.
And that afternoon, we ran into a German point that was pretty well grouped with a lot of soldiers, and so we went in to push at them, and they circled around the back of us, cut us off. And So the sergeant said he'd go back and get the rest of the men and bring them up to our level. And so he tried to go back, but they shot and killed him. And then the corporal, the second in command, he decided to go back and get it. So he goes back, and I didn't hear from him. So I decided to crawl across his field. And there was grass in his field. And I started to crawl across this field, and there was a man behind me. There was an elderly man with glasses. He said, I see a German. He says, give me your gun. My gun won't fire. My gun won't fire. He was crawling. He must have got a lot of dirt in the gun or something. He wouldn't fire. So I shoved my gun to him, you know, and I saw him when he aimed it. I looked down the barrel, and he was shooting our corporal. Our corporal was right alongside the hedgerow, and he was still alive, and he shot and killed the corporal.
My home policy, I wage war. My foreign policy, I wage war. All the time, I wage war.
So I kept praying. Then the Americans started shooting again back and forth. And then I was finally got into a prayer where I felt, I'm kind of a religious person. I felt that he was there with me. And I could feel a pressure on my head back here that told me to stay. Stay where you are. Don't go over that hedgerow. Stay where you are. So I relaxed because I thought he was there with me. And I relaxed. And then they were shooting back and forth, and it didn't bother me. It didn't bother me. And it was a weird feeling, really.
If we justify war, it is because all peoples justify the traits of which they find themselves possessed.
We were recovering a tank up on the Elbe River, and VJ Day, I had been put in a hospital. They thought I might have had appendicitis, and we were watching a movie, and in the middle of the movie everything stopped and the lights came on, and some guy came out and stood up in front of the audience and says, well, it's all over, you know. And pretty soon at the back of the audience somebody said, well, let's see the movie.
The most beautiful thing I've ever seen was the love between the soldiers. They loved each other. It was beyond brotherhood. It was beyond homosexuality. It had nothing to do with sex. It was the love that they had for each other. And, you know, they would beg us not to let him die. And he's got children. He's my best friend. He saved my life, blah, blah, blah. All these wonderful things that these men had done with each other, you know, proving that brotherhood is beyond anything most people could ever understand if you've not been in a war. And it was just so profound and beautiful. One night, two soldiers got drunk and they got beat up. One guy got beat up and he came in with his friend. And he got beat up because he was calling these black soldiers every name in the book. And his friend just treated him like a wife would, you know, just calm down. Oh my God, these nurses and doctors, they're officers, you know, don't say those words, you know, just go, no, just calm down, please calm down. And he finally calmed his friend down, and we sent them off to x-ray. Now his friend was black. He was calling these guys all kinds of awful names, but his best friend, he was standing there, was black, and he just totally didn't care. It was his friend, and he was gonna take care of him no matter what. It was unconditional. And that's something you don't see in real life. And that's something I wish I could see in real life. You have to be in a war zone in order to appreciate life and love that you can have with another human being that's beyond a romantic love, that's beyond a father-child love, beyond a brother love, just way beyond. And I hope they both made it through.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.